books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and I've avoided the temptation to do episode 404, Podcast Not Found. So welcome to a recap of 2024, part one. Coming up on today's show, we'll hear from Hibanur Khan and our book Safiya's War. We'll talk to Louise Hare about Harlem After Midnight. We have the first ever debut fiction prize winner of the Nero Book Awards, Michael McGee. In March, we talked to Becky Holmes and she discovered that Keanu Reeves was not in love with her. We'll have Linda Marin up in a moment with Last Chance in Paris. But back in January of 2024, we spoke to Hester Musson about her gothic debut, The Beholders. June 1787. The body of a boy is pulled from the depths of the River Thames, suspected to be the beloved missing child of the widely acclaimed Liberal MP, Ralph Gethin. 4 months earlier, Harriet is a young maid, newly employed at Finton Hall, fleeing the drudgery of an unwanted engagement in the small village where she grew up. Harriet is entranced by the grand country hall. She is entranced too by her glamorous mistress, Clara Gethin, whose singing floats through the house. But Clara, though captivating, is erratic. The master of the house is a much lauded politician, but he is strangely absent, and some of their beautiful belongings seem to tell terrible stories. I'll talk to author Hester Musson in a moment, but for now, the audio version is narrated by Ashley Tucker, with Harriet Carmichael and Elliot Fitzpatrick.
Finton Hall, February, Wednesday, the 27th of February. Letter from Mother, as expected.
Dear Harriet, thank you for the money you sent us last week. How much better for us all if you brought it home with you yourself. Your letter has put me about, I won't pretend otherwise. And you know the reason. What am I to tell your father and sisters? You must know that your father is no better. The doctor took me to one side yesterday to say his lungs are so weak he may not be able to work for months, if at all. These last years in the quarry have told on him. I always said it would come to no good, digging up farmland for stones, and now they are after building an ironworks too, I'm told. Much good it will do your family. Your youngest sister is to be scullery maid at Beechwood, but you know how little we can expect from that. Your money will at least pay for the aprons and caps she needs. The rest will have to be put by for the doctor. James Stanworth, who was always so good to us, is leaving for America, and we cannot trust on Lady Stanworth's kindness forever. If there wasn't William waiting, I would give thanks that you had found such a good place. I asked the new butler at Beechwood if he knew of Mr. and Mrs. Gethin. I pretended I was asking for your father's cousin's child. That is the wretched position you have put me in. And he said there is much talk in London of Mr. Gethin doing great things for the country and for workers with his modern ideas. But there is no reason for you to stay in service now, Harriet. William, as you surely know, is to be made head gardener and have the Mill Lane cottage. You could ensure your father's comfort and put all our minds at rest. I only hope you have not lost sight of yourself. William is still most kind and loving to us all. That is something else we cannot trust on forever. With love, Mother.
It's set in 1878 and it begins with the trial of a woman who is the wife of an MP and she's accused of murdering their baby son. But the story then jumps back a few months and it's told completely through the diaries of a housemaid called Harriet Watkins who goes to work for them at their country estate. And Harriet is trying to find a way out of her own limited life choices. She doesn't want to go home and marry her childhood sweetheart, which is what's expected of her and is really the only sensible thing for her to do in her position because she doesn't want to be a housemaid either. That's a very hard life and precarious one as well. She's looking for a bigger purpose, and she thinks she's found it working in this amazing house, Finton Hall, for these amazing employers. She's particularly captivated by her mistress, Clara, who lives to sing and fills the house with her singing voice. And she seems to see more in Harriet than anyone else ever does. And she doesn't see the master very much to begin with, but he's in London, a rising star of the Liberal Party. She feels like maybe this is a life of service which would have more meaning for her. But as she begins to understand what's really going on in Finton Hall, she starts to doubt her decision. It looks like a fairy tale to start with, but the hall is actually quite sinister. There's things going on which she becomes much more uneasy about. And in the end, she has to make a choice about how far she's willing to go and how much she's prepared to risk to do what she thinks is the right thing.
Friday, the 1st of March. I'm on the floor in the pantry, so I'll be out of sight if someone comes into the kitchen. There's a drawer in the dresser there where I keep this book, but I'll be finding a new place for it now there's something in it to read. It's so perfect and weighty in its green cover. So expecting of a better hand, I've been half afraid of it. I've been waiting for a minute's quietness or for something to happen that's worthy of disturbing the lovely blankness of the page. But there's neither peace nor interest to be had at Finton Hall. So this is how I'm starting in earnest, hurriedly scratching out in pencil whatever comes to mind, sitting between a sack of beetroot and an old milk churn.
I was interested in themes around service, and so it became about service and power and how our perception of both of those things can be so distorted that terrible things can happen right in front of us without us really being able to see it.
And what sort of drew you to that time period of the 1870s?
Well, it was originally the story was going to be set in the present, a very different story, but it was going to have a sort of subplot of these little diary entries sort of ticking along in the background. And my main character, who was trying to unravel a mystery of the past, doesn't actually read them. The reader does until the very end when she finds the entire diary. But I started writing the little diary inserts, and they just completely took over. Once I had Harriet's voice, it just wouldn't shut up. And so in the end, I was like, oh, well, this has to be the entire book. And I've always been fascinated by the Victorian period. It was set particularly when it is really to serve the book that never got written because it needed to be a certain number of generations. But once I got into that period, it made sense for a lot of reasons.
Now, setting it in that time will involve a bit of research. Did you read any real diaries from the period?
Yes, as much as possible. I mean, there aren't that many that I could find servants' diaries available. I think perhaps they just weren't written because they just didn't have time to. There was one that was very influential, which was by a woman called Hannah Colwick. The only reason she wrote her diary was because she was having a love affair with a barrister, and he was fascinated by servants and wanted to know all about her daily life. So sort of begrudgingly, she did start writing a diary for him. And it's so interesting because she begins by just really listing chores that she had to do every day, which was brilliant for research. But then as she writes, the writing obviously became more important to her, and she starts to, it's almost like a confidant. She starts to figure things out, and, you know, she'll even complain about her relationship. It obviously becomes very important to her. So that was really useful to use for thinking about Harriet as well, because Harriet, she also, I nicked the idea, she doesn't really want to write a diary, but one of her former employer asks her to. She says her handwriting will become neater if she writes every day, so why doesn't she write a diary? And throughout the book, she starts to wonder why she's writing it. And towards the end, she starts to realise that it's not actually her own story that she's been recording. Her whole diary has been a kind of act of witnessing, and that's why it's been important.
That whole interview can be found in episode 355. In February, we had our last chance in Paris with Linda Marin. Last Chance in Paris is a funny, moving and above all life-affirming story of a make-or-break trip to Paris by an Irish couple following a tragedy. It's the debut novel of prolific reader and bookstagrammer Linda Marin. And as we'll find out later on, the book has even been endorsed by President Bartlett himself, Martin Sheen. If you're listening to this on the day of release, the book came out yesterday in print, as an e-book and in audio as read by M.R. Heatley.
Only an idiot would travel without a book. Only a fool, thought Claire, would prioritise clean knickers and kitten heels ahead of reading material in the great 10-kilogram baggage challenge. And yet, here she was, flipping from the front to the back of the flight safety card. It didn't even have words, only line drawings of people calmly flinging themselves out of planes. A woman standing in the aisle tugged theatrically on an oxygen mask, its disconnected tubing dangling loose at her hip. "If you're travelling with a child, secure your own mask first," she said. "Breathe normally." Watching from 6A, the window seat, Claire wondered how many parents obeyed that rule. When it came to it, when the plane was falling out of the sky, when alarms were ringing and hearts exploding, how many parents put on their own mask first? And did putting on their own mask first make them a better parent or a worse one? "In the event of an emergency, assume the brace position." The flight attendant was old school. Sensible court shoes, lacquered chignon, makeup guaranteed to survive a sea landing. Her name was Imelda, according to the name tag on her Kenmare green lapel. Imelda was not, Claire thought, a woman who would welcome philosophical questions from her audience.
The central characters of the book are an Irish couple, Ronan and Claire, who, you know, they're young, they're not long married, and they've just had an absolutely brutal year, as bad as things could go for them. And even though they both have the very best of intentions, they're having a really hard time holding their marriage together. And in an act of goodwill, Ronan decides to whisk Claire away for the weekend to go to Paris. She doesn't really want to go, but again, in an act of goodwill, she says, "Yeah, we'll try and make this work." So they go to Paris. But, you know, it's not all roses or anything. Neither of them are really expecting anything from it. And then the story unfolds in the way that they interact with various people that they meet on the streets of Paris, lots of really different, disparate characters that they meet, and how just really small acts of kindness between strangers on the street can change lives fundamentally.
It was the smell of the place that did it. Sure, there were announcements in French and French voices murmuring all around her, but it was the particular cocktail of smells, the warmth of dark roasted coffee beans and browned butter, the nose-tickling perfumes and the murky underlay of cigarette smoke, that made some signpost in Claire's brain swivel on its rusty hinges and point to Paris. It felt like walking through the back of the wardrobe, crossing the threshold to a place where expectations were different, or maybe gravity had just a fraction less pull. Anything might happen here, because the rules, at least some of them, didn't apply.
Yeah, there's lots of people in there, from a Hollywood producer to Ukrainian refugees. How is you Ukrainian?
No, I don't have any Ukrainian. That involved a lot of research and a lot of help. I got in touch with a translation agency here in Cork, and I just asked them to help me with, and they were really lovely. They were really interested that, you know, that I was putting a Ukrainian character into my novel, and they couldn't have been more helpful. In fact, they really, you know, they kind of gave me the background on the sort of phrases that Ukrainians would genuinely use when they're saying goodbye to each other. And in that conversation that I had with that translator, it was actually really quite touching, you know, because he'd clearly said goodbye to someone. So that was an exploration of something I didn't know anything about. And the whole novel, in fact, for me, was an experiment, because I'd never written fiction at all before, and I didn't know if I could. And that was probably, putting that Ukrainian character in was probably one of the riskiest things I did, and one of the things I've worried most about and still worry about, to be honest with you.
Yeah, because I've read that you started writing this 20 years ago. Obviously, the crisis in Ukraine wasn't happening 20 years ago, so was that something you added quite late in the process?
Well, When I say that I, yeah, so really what happened 20 years ago was that my husband, we'd been married about 5 years, we were stone broke, and he was on a promise to bring me to Paris, and he couldn't afford to. So he gave me a notebook and he wrote on the front of it, "For when I take you to Paris." And I started scribbling ideas and things into that notebook. But that would only have been really just, you know, bare bones ideas. And gradually little things got scribbled into it. So that by the time we went to Paris, it was more that I had become certain that I wanted to write a novel set in Paris than that I had started writing it. And then we had this amazing weekend for our 20th wedding anniversary. We finally went to Paris and had this incredible, incredible weekend where just flukish things happened and we ran into people, you know, more than once, and people were nice to us on the street. We were just charmed. It was lovely. And when we came back, I wrote it up for my husband more as a sort of a memoir saying, you know, we finally went to Paris and it was great.
Linda's whole interview is in episode 358.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
We are having a recap of 2024, and in March, Becky Holmes discovered Keanu Reeves was not in love with her. Becky Holmes' Twitter, or X feed, looks at the murky world of online romance fraud. From oil rig workers to soldiers to celebrities such as Keanu Reeves or Brad Pitt, Becky has spent years dealing with these online fraudsters. And now that Twitter feed has become a book, read by Becky herself.
It was while the world was imploding in on itself that I became desperate enough to join the rest of the world online, firstly through dating sites. In the first few months of 2020, I spent hours miserably and pointlessly swiping away at the portal of despair that is Tinder, hopelessly searching for a man to talk to whose profile picture wasn't him holding a dead fish or a selfie in a public toilet mirror with a urinal behind him. I cannot believe how many urinals I saw within the first few days. A quick word to the men listening to this who are currently looking for love online. No one wants to see a massive smelly trout or a massive smelly trough. Having exhausted the profiles of all Tinder males within a 50-mile radius and resisted the temptation to widen my search to men aged anywhere between 18 and 80 worldwide, I thought, sod it, I'm joining Twitter. That will surely banish all feelings of isolation and depression, and I'll immediately find my people. I'll make tons of online friends and I'll never feel lonely or depressed again. I've been asked many times why I chose @deathtospinach as my Twitter handle, and this seems as good a time as any to reveal the reason. The truth is, here we go, buckle up, I don't like spinach. A miserable vegetable with the texture of filamentous algae and the taste of rotten anuses, but I assume. If I'd thought for a moment that I'd grow a decent Twitter following and end up writing a book because of it, I might well have chosen a more relevant handle. But as it is, I'm now stuck with this and am regularly referred to as the spinach woman. As a spinach hater, it has rather backfired to forevermore be named after it, rather like someone with arachnophobia being called terrifyingly massive spider woman.
Clip of Becky Holmes reading from her book, Keanu Reeves is Not in Love with You. And Becky joins us now. Now, Becky, tell us about your celebrity boyfriends.
I have many, many celebrity boyfriends. Keanu Reeves, Brad Pitt, Liam Neeson, Jason Statham, Prince William, Prince Andrew, which was slightly awkward at the time. I have a plethora of celebrity boyfriends, Robert.
And it's not just celebrities. You've got a gaggle of soldiers and pilots and oil rig workers as well. Now, how do you attract these guys?
Well, they come through to you when you're on social media. If you don't have your security settings very high, then they start to approach you through whether it's Twitter or Instagram or dating sites, of course. And most people will block and delete them, but I like to sort of play along and waste a bit of their time. Now, that's great fun for me. The problem is that as soon as you engage with one of these people, your details are sold onto what they call a suckers list, which means that you are then kind of fair game for anybody who's bought this list, and you end up with absolutely tons of them.
And you've been posting these up on your Twitter feed at Death to Spinach, which I've been following for a while. What have you got against spinach?
Oh, do you know, I can't tell you how disgusting I think it is. And the problem is I'm vegan. So actually, spinach should be an amazing source of nutrients for me, but I can't even look at the stuff. So when I obviously joined Twitter, I had no idea that it would turn into this and I'd end up doing a book and forever be known as the spinach woman. It wasn't in my plan for life, I have to say.
As I said, the Twitter feed became a book. How did the author Kimberly Chambers get involved in that process?
Oh, so when I started posting these up on Twitter and my following started to grow, and I noticed that Kimberly Chambers followed me, and I love her books. I become completely obsessed every time she brings a new one out, and she's about to as well. So I'm really excited. And I messaged her through Twitter and I said, oh my God, I love your stuff. I'm so pleased that you're following me. And she said to me, oh no, I think your stuff is hilarious. I'm going to tell my agent about you. So once that process started and I'd been talking to the agency for a little while, we then agreed that I'll put a book proposal together. And then it's just spiraled from there.
And you went with Unbound. How long did it take to get funded on there?
It very much depends on the number of people who come forward to pledge for the books. Now, I was very, very lucky. So I think Unbound tend to sort of say, you know, you should be fully funded within a year. I was very lucky in that mine was funded in about 3 weeks. because when you've got a quite a large social media following, if people have been following you for a while and they like the things you do, I think it's much easier to ask people to pledge and kind of effectively pre-order their book, even though you know they know they're going to be waiting a long time for it. So I cannot tell you. I mean, I said this to somebody earlier, that when I hear people on TV or radio say, oh, I'm so grateful for everyone's support, I used to think, oh yeah, whatever. But actually, having had the support of so many people, it's just been brilliant, and it wouldn't have happened otherwise.
Now, the book came out a couple of weeks ago, and there is an audio version as well that you recorded. We'll talk about that now in a minute. But as funny as it is to see about Liam Neeson asking you for money for his latest film, there is a really serious side to this, because romance, fraud and scams like this are far more common than we think.
They are. I think it's probably one of the most underreported crimes that there is. There's this real stigma around being a victim of romance fraud, because people, they really believe the stereotype that in order to be a victim of romance fraud, you have to be a middle-aged woman who's lonely and desperate for a man. And in actual fact, it's simply not the case. The people that I interviewed for the book, they were clever, charming, articulate, you know, a good circle of friends. This stereotype, we need to get rid of that, because then I think more people will start to come forward and to report what's happened to them.
Yeah, my mum was scammed. It wasn't a romance scam, but it was the same sort of thing. It was an authorised push payment fraud.
Yeah.
And she was embarrassed about it, and she said she fell for it. And you've got a problem with those words, fell for it, yeah.
I do. And I talk about this quite a lot. The words fall for, it's something that we use only when it comes to fraud. So, you know, you wouldn't get home and say, oh my goodness, I've just fell for a mugging. It wouldn't happen. You wouldn't say, oh, I've fallen for domestic abuse. It's not something that people ever use other than for fraud or scams. And I think it belittles the crime, because essentially what it's saying is that it's something you walked into. And that's not how it is. Romance fraud is a crime that happens to you, just like any other crime.
Yeah, I went on a bit of a deep dive researching this, and I ended up reading scripts that they give out to people. And It's very detailed. It's like, well, why can't you call me on your mobile? Sorry, we can't use mobile phones here because the Taliban use them to detonate bombs.
Exactly.
And, it's so detailed and goes a lot deeper than you think.
It does. And one of the reasons that romance fraudsters use particular jobs, so in the army, a doctor working in a war-torn country, somebody on an oil rig, for example, it's for the very reason that you've just said, which is that they've got a really good excuse to say, no, I can't ring you, or no, I can't speak to you on video, or more importantly, I can't access my money. So, you're absolutely right to pick up on that point.
Is there a difference between people scamming women and scamming men?
Yeah, there is. And it's a stereotype, but unfortunately, I think it's true in the world of romance fraud. So it tends to be, and I'm not saying 100% by any means, but the pattern tends to be that women are wooed by the promise of love and romance, and men are wooed by the promise of some kind of sexual gratification. Now, the problem with that is that often that ends up in sextortion, which is when somebody is blackmailing someone over intimate images that they've received. So, although initially it might seem quite different, ultimately it's all about getting money out of the victim.
One September evening, I was contacted by Handsome Raymond. I'd like to take some credit for this next paragraph, please, because I'm saying it exactly how it was written, and I've entered into a not considerable number of altercations with autocorrect when I was writing it. Raymond wrote, "How are you doing today? Hope you stay safe as well. I am delighted to have you here on my Twitter. I am glad to browse through your profile and as well watch your pictures. I must confess that you physically represent what I seek in my ideal woman. Your looks got me impressed. Sincerely, I like you, and I would wish to exchange further correspondence with you. I will be glad if you give me the privilege to know more about your person. Let's write and get acquainted with each other. Maybe we could be best of friend. My name is Raymond. I'm from United States of America widowed."
You can hear Becky's whole interview in episode 361. Also in March, we had the first ever Nero Book Awards, and although he didn't get the overall prize, which went to Paul Murray for The Bee Sting, the debut fiction prize went to Michael McGee. His book, Close to Home, is narrated by Conor McNeill.
"There was nothing to it. I swung and hit him and he dropped. A girl came flying forward and pushed me. What'd you do that for? The lad was lying there and I was standing over him, and there were people all around me making noise. By the time I got away from the tussle, two Land Rovers had pulled up. A jaded-looking peeler with a receding hairline came towards me. 'Is that blood?' he said, pointing to a stain on my shirt that could have been anything. He took my name and number and told me he would be in touch. I held my hands up and said that was no problem. 'The lad came at me,' I said. I didn't know what to do. At the top of the street, the lad was put on a stretcher and the stretcher was heaved into the back of an ambulance. 'I think it's best you make your way home,' the peeler said. I'd have said that he was a good peeler, a helpful peeler. 'We'll be in touch,' he said, and I thanked him. 'Thanks very much,' I said."
A clip of Conor McNeill reading from the audio version of Michael McGee's Close to Home, and Michael joins me now. Now, Michael, tell us about Close to Home.
"Well, Close to Home's about, it's about a young guy from Belfast. He's just returned home from university in Liverpool. He's from West Belfast, actually, more specifically. And he's returned home from university in Liverpool, having gone there sort of to try and, escape in some way. And upon returning to his, that sort of world, he sort of falls back into old behaviours. And one night at a house party, he gets into a bit of an argument and punches this guy, assaults him. And it's a pretty bad assault. And I guess the rest of the story then is sort of him coming to terms with what he did while also trying to navigate a city that's still sort of trying to recover from the 30-year conflict, from the Troubles. And also it's sort of set just after the economic crash in 2008. So there's a sort of economic downturn. There's not a lot in the way of opportunities for young people in particular. a lot of the people around him have lost their livelihoods. And he finds it quite hard to just sort of get on his feet and get a job and all that kind of thing. And I guess like it's also got a lot to do with the fact that he's the only person in his family to have gone to university, the only person in his social group, his group of friends who went to university. And so he feels this kind of dislocation and has this sort of impulse to try and get away, but he doesn't even know what that really looks like. But I guess that's what the journey of the book is, I suppose.
You yourself went away to university and came back, and the book's called Close to Home. So is it quite close to home?
To be fair, it is. It's very close to home in all sorts of ways. It actually started out, the early incarnations of it was a memoir, or at least that was kind of where I was going with it. And I think I probably needed to look at it in that way. At the start, I think I also the book was actually born out of a writing exercise that a friend of mine sort of set me, you know. It was back in 2016. I just started doing a PhD. I was very, very lucky to be able to get the opportunity to study a PhD in creative writing at Queen's University in Belfast. I think it sort of came with a bit of pressure. I think I was at a point in my life where there was these sort of changes happening, and I was in a sort of period of transition, and I was struggling to find my way in, essentially, to the things I wanted and needed to write about. And a friend of mine, Tom Morris, who's a brilliant writer in himself, he recognized this in the work that I was producing and could sort of sense that something wasn't clicking. And he set me this task of writing a letter. He said to write a letter to someone you know and respect, and just start at any point in your life and go from there. And so that's what I did. I sat down and started writing. And over the course of about 2 or 3 months, this letter, I just kept writing and going back to it. It was almost like a diary that kept getting longer. And after a few months, I sort of had this manuscript that was highly confessional. And I had said all the things about myself and my life and the place that I came from that I had never really been able to say before. And that was, you know, quite cathartic in all sorts of ways. But then I had this sort of manuscript that the whole point of writing it was to write it that no one would ever read it. And so that gave me sort of a degree of confidence and allowed me to speak in a way. And then I guess the next 5 or 6 years was a process of trying to figure out what the hell to do with it, you know, and it was sort of moving back and forth between memoir and fiction. And then I sort of settled on fictionalizing and giving myself that space. And I think that was needed to sort of create distance between myself and the material I was writing about. I think whenever it was too close to me, I couldn't see it. And I think when you're writing, you kind of need to be able to step back. You know, you need that sort of distance in yourself. You need to place yourself in the narrator's shoes and seeing the world through their shoes and not your shoes. Even if the narrator's sort of you or another version of you, you sort of need to see them as somebody else, if that makes sense. And I almost looked at Sean then as a sort of younger version of myself or a version of myself that no longer existed, you know, and then that allowed me that objective distance that I needed to be able to tell the story.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor, and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports talking books.
I hate to think of people being cut off from that pleasure through no fault of their own. And it is very, very difficult to live without sight when you have been seeing. But the truth is that there is no reason for them to lose their pleasure in reading if we can just create the talking books. You know, the nightmare that faces us is how few books become talking books. And we have to change that. You know, these books will last forever now under the new technology. It's not as if one's doing it and then they get read for a summer and thrown out. This is forever. This whole business of talking books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk. Two authors still to come in a recap of 2024. And as we entered April, we went to Harlem After Midnight with author Louise Hare. Louise Hare was last on Read On 2 years ago, where she took us on board the Queen Mary for a transatlantic cruise with a side order of murder in her book Miss Aldridge Regrets. Well, the ship has docked in New York, and the sequel to that book, Harlem After Midnight, picked up on the same day the first book ended. We'll talk to author Louise Hare in a moment, after we hear from the audio version, narrated by Leonie Elliott.
I'd only been in the apartment for 15 minutes, but already it felt like home. The bedroom that would be mine for the next fortnight was perfect. I might never want to leave. The bed was immaculately made with blue cotton sheets and a pristine white comforter tucked into the foot. The floor made of the same sturdy varnished wood that ran through the entirety of Claudette and Lewis Linfield's home. Clean towels had been folded and placed on a navy blue velvet armchair that sat in the ideal position, in a corner close to the window where I could sit and catch the last rays of sunshine at the end of the day. Claude had even laid out a selection of her favourite books on the bedside table to ensure I had something to read before going to sleep. She was a librarian by trade, so I suppose the habit ran deep. "You about settled in?" Claude Linfield had a constant, easy smile. Considering that she and her husband had been complete strangers only a couple of hours earlier, I already felt that there was no place safer in the whole of New York than in this cosy apartment. "Yes, thank you." I moved to let her join me at the window, looking down into the street that was so different to the narrow London roads that I was used to. Wider, the buildings far taller, everything just that little bit bigger and brighter than back at home. "It's so kind of you to let me stay. I know that I could have stayed on at the hotel, but hotels are for those without their own people," she told me. "Far as I'm concerned, you're with Will, and that makes you family. He's as good as a brother to me and Lewis."
Harlem After Midnight is actually a sequel to the book Miss Aldridge Regrets. So it features the same main character of Lena Aldridge. In the first book, she is traveling from the UK to New York. And as the title might suggest to you, this second book is about her time in New York, but in Harlem specifically, and it's another murder mystery. So essentially, she's really unlucky when it comes to stumbling across murders.
Will Goodman, the reason I was in Harlem and no longer resident in the luxurious but impersonal Sherry Netherland Hotel. We'd met on the voyage over from England. A cliche of a story. I had been a passenger. He was the band leader, playing to the rich and famous every night in the Starlight Club on the HMS Queen Mary. It had been quite the voyage, and the addition of a whirlwind romance had left my head spinning. Perhaps it was foolish to throw my lot in with a man I'd only just met, but I trusted Will. There were so many others whom I couldn't, and so when he'd offered to arrange for me to stay with friends of his, I'd agreed without a second thought.
Now, the last time you were on, you said this sequel, or the first draft at least, picked up on the same day that Miss Aldridge Regrets finished. Is that still the case?
It is, yeah. It sort of begins with a prologue, which is actually in the future. But yeah, essentially the first page of chapter one is the same day. So where the first book finishes, she's just got a train up to Harlem, and that's where you meet her.
And there's actually two time periods in this book. It goes from 1908 to 1936. Did New York itself change much over those years?
It did, and a lot more than I had expected with my limited knowledge of the period before I planned this book. So it essentially meant two lots of research because the areas people lived in changed. So I guess even today we think of Harlem as an area where, you know, it was very popular with the African-American community. But in 1908, that wasn't the case. It was still more Jewish and Italian. And so I had to research these two different areas for my characters in finding, you know, where they would have lived, how they would have lived their lives.
Yeah, something would have happened in the interim. So tell us about the Harlem Renaissance.
Yeah, so the Holland Renaissance, mostly it's associated with the 1920s, so it's a little bit before this book, but sort of going on into the 30s. And that was, I guess, this really sort of creative time and a time when the sort of Black community had sort of established itself in Harlem. And you were getting this sort of a Black middle class, but also especially creative. So lots of writers and artists and having these amazing sort of jazz parties. And I mean, it just sounds fabulous. I'm sure it was, you know, everyday life was exactly like ours today. You've got, you know, the ups and downs, but it just seemed like such an interesting period, quite intellectual and creative.
My dad went to New York in the mid-90s, and he had one thing that he wanted to see in the Carnegie Hall Museum was Benny Goodman's clarinet, because he was into jazz. And it took me far longer than I want to admit that I realised each section or each chapter is named after a jazz standard of the time.
Yeah. I mean, I really enjoy jazz. I used to play clarinet. I still do a little bit, but not as often as I did as a kid. And so it was quite important to me to, A, it was kind of fun just researching, because I wanted to choose songs that would have been published that Lena herself could have sang, because she's a jazz singer. So I wanted to make sure that I, A, found stuff that came out either 1936 or prior. But it was also fun to have a playlist and sort of immerse myself in that period that way. I think with these two books, having a jazz singer, there's lots of music across both books of that period. And then my very first book was called This Lovely City. And in that book, I had a main character who played clarinet in a sort of jazz band. So yeah, I think the jazz has definitely been coming out so far. I may do have a change of direction, but it's been nice to have, I guess, a bit of myself in the books, even though the characters are very different to me.
Now, you mentioned the word planning. Does that mean you're a planner rather than a pantser?
Unfortunately, no. I'm very good at sort of super vague plans. Like, I would like to write something that is a bit like this. That's, to me, is a plan. Whereas I think real planners would be like, where's your spreadsheet? Where's your, you know, your list of what's going to happen? For me, especially in the murder mystery writing business, is a bit unusual, because I know a lot of crime writers, they need to have a plan. They need to know who did it. And very often I don't know who did it until I get to the end. So yeah, definitely not a plotter.
Louise Hare's whole interview can be found in episode 366. Now, in May, we were looking forward to the Yodo Carnegies. It was eventually won by Joseph Coilho for The Boy in the Maze, with Tia Fisher winning the Shadowers Award. But to end today, here's one of the shortlisted authors, Hiba Noor Khan, and her book, Sophia's War. War has come to the streets of Paris, and Sophia's life has changed forever. Her best friend's family have fled, and the bombing makes her afraid to leave the mosque where she lives. But when her father is arrested by the Nazis for his secret resistance work, it falls to Sophia to run the dangerous errands around the city. The audio version of Sophia's War by author Hiba Noor Khan, who will join me in a moment, is read by Shala Nix.
It is only in holy places of worship and libraries that you have to whisper, for they are both sacred in their own special ways. Sophia spent as many afternoons as she could here in the dusty stillness of the library, poring over atlases, maps, and travel logs. Madame Odette, the kind librarian, never asked her unnecessary questions. She knew why Sophia came. Perhaps it was the same reason Madame Odette worked there. The promise of pages. The silence that seemed to shimmer. Madame Odette would lead Sophia down the echoey hallway, with its dark mahogany walls, her small heels clicking all the way to the world section. She wore pleated skirts and bright cardigans. Sophia's favourite was black wool, with tiny colourful stitches all over, as if handfuls of sugar sprinkles had been thrown across it like confetti. Sophia would choose where in the world she wanted to explore, and Madame Odette would roll out the right maps and pile up helpful books on the leather-topped desk. The names of faraway places enchanted Sophia. Some, in particular, seemed to call out to her from the coffee-coloured pages of old maps. Jerusalem, Manila, and Harare, summoned her in sacred, hushed library tones.
Hi, I'm Hiba Noor Khan. I'm the author of Sophia's War, which is based on a true story from history. So it's based and inspired by the real life resistance mission of those in the Grand Paris Mosque against the Nazis in World War II. And the bravery and the commitment to humanity of the mosque community and the leader helped save the lives of hundreds, maybe even thousands of Jews who would have otherwise been killed by the Nazis. It's told through the eyes of 11-year-old Sophia. She actually turns 12 in the story. She is animal loving. She's also obsessed with maps, and she has this really unique ability with navigation and directions, in that whenever she goes on a journey or she walks on a path or she hears some directions or she sees a map, that place, that journey, that route will be imprinted in her brain forever. It's something that's very, very important actually to the story as we get into the thick of the plot. And I won't obviously give any spoilers, but she's also very, very caring. She's very, very curious, and she's a little bit feisty, which gets her into trouble more than one occasion.
She whispered the names of cities, towns, islands, and lagoons, like secrets, feeling a thirst for the world. Not everyone was allowed into these rooms whenever they liked. You needed permission and a special pass, but Madame Odette made an exception for Sophia. 2 years ago, when Sophia's father had first brought her to the library, Sophia had wandered off and found Madame Odette sitting behind her desk, chewing a strawberry bonbon. "Sorry to disturb you, Madame. I'd like to see a map of Algeria, please. My grandma showed me one she has, but it's ripped on the Tunisia side. Everything to the right of Annaba, El Bouni, Souk Ahras, and Tebessa is gone, and I'd really like to see the El Kala region properly."
And the book opens in 1940 in Paris, and Sophia's world has changed almost overnight. She's been used to freedom and roaming the streets of her city and, you know, chilling and relaxing with her friends and family. And all of a sudden, everything starts to turn dark, and there are Nazi soldiers in her city on the streets. And her best friend, who's called Isabel, and her family flee to the south because they no longer feel safe in Paris. And Sophia starts to feel very, very alone and very, very trapped and suffocated. And then to top all of that off, her father starts acting really strange. So she's always been really close to him, and she's helped him out with his job and his office. And now he's locking the door to his office, and he's hiding his bags, and he's not really saying very much. And then she notices that he's disappearing at strange times. And Sophia, being Sophia, she sets out to find out what's going on, and she gets drawn into the beating heart of the resistance efforts of the mosque. So on the pages of the book, you'll find animal rescues, there are spy missions, you'll meet botanists and shepherds and rebellious imams and undercover librarians, and there's a lot of friendship in the story, there's a lot of courage, and ultimately it's a book about hope.
And remarkably, it's based on real events. Tell us about the person the book is dedicated to.
The dedication reads, "For Sidi Abdul Qadir Ben Ghabrik and all the unsung heroes who follow maps of light against all odds, and for every child affected by the darknesses of war, may you be the last." So the man's name, the man who's mentioned in the dedication, he was actually the leader of the Grand Paris Mosque. So he was the main man behind all of this incredible rescue mission. He was originally from Algeria, and he's one of my absolute heroes. So when I came across this story, I was absolutely just blown away by what he managed to do, because I think in so many instances, it's nothing short of miraculous. I mean, I've been thinking about this a lot recently. So he was arrested multiple times because the Nazis actually had a bit of an instinct, a bit of an inkling that he was up to something, but he managed to hide his traces and any evidence of the operation so well that they never managed to convict him. They used to bring him into prison, so they would do raids of the mosque, and they would arrest him many, many times over the years. And every time they had to release him because they couldn't find anything solid. But as soon as he returned, as soon as he was free, he would go straight back and he would carry on fighting and he would carry on resisting. I was thinking, you know, there are obviously a lot of people in the war context the majority of people who were sort of just focused on their own survival and the survival maybe of their loved ones. And, you know, they sort of just tried to lay low and get through day by day by keeping a low profile. And then you come across people like Ben Ghabrit and many other heroes as well that, you know, are more well known, who put everything at stake day after day. You know, if he was found out, there's no doubt that he would have been killed, along with probably all and everyone that he loved. And I was just thinking, what is it that makes somebody do that? What is it that makes somebody put everything that means something to them on the line and at stake? And I just keep coming back to this idea of love and of this deep awareness within him that knew that the most precious and the most sacred thing in existence is human life. And it doesn't matter whether that life belongs to the same religion or the same race or the same nationality as you, or whether they look like you or they speak the same language as you, that life is everything. And he's one of my absolute heroes, as I said, because I think his commitment to that was just so beautiful and profound. And he was also, I'd say, a genius, because the way that he managed to run the resistance mission was just phenomenal. There were so many little hacks and little ways that he managed, like installing a bell underneath his desk in his office. And that bell was connected to all of the rooms and the chambers and the prayer halls and the courtyards of the mosque. It's a very, very big mosque. And when he was bringing Jews in to the mosque to find refuge and shelter, as I mentioned, they were having these raids regularly. So he connected this bell to every single space in the mosque. And he posted a man whose job was just to look outside the mosque for any soldiers who might be suspicious and might want to do a raid. And when that man spotted some soldiers walking towards the mosque, he would quickly run and tell Ben Ghabrit, you know, there's danger on the horizon. And Ben Ghabrit would then run up to his office and he would ring the bell. And any Jews who were in the mosque, anywhere in the mosque, would then hear the bell and they would know we need to start moving down towards the basements. And as quickly as they could, they would start to move. And then Ben Ghabrit would go to the front of the mosque and he would find the Nazis at the door, and they'd be banging on the door and they'd be like, let us in, you know, we're going to catch you out today, we know you're up to something. And he'd play it all cool and he'd be like, yeah, sure, you know, come in, welcome, we'll even give you tea, we've got nothing to hide, but first, because this is a mosque and it's a place of prayer, we must ask that you take your shoes off, because that's something that you do in a mosque. And then the soldiers would have to bend down, and soldiers' boots are big, heavy, clunky things, and they're usually laced all the way up, almost to your knees. So that's a lot of laces. And they'd have to untie the laces and heave the boots off. And that would take maybe a couple of minutes. And in that time, all the Jews would have made it down to the basements, the doors would be locked, and they'd be safe. And every single time that the Nazis did this and they raided the mosque, they never found a trace. So yeah, he was a really, really remarkable man, and the sort of he's one of the main characters of the story.
And yet we've never really heard of him. Why do you think this part of history has been overlooked?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I honestly had exactly the same questions when I came across this story, because I think I'm one example of the wider picture in terms of the fact that people just don't know about this. So when I came across the story, I was really stunned. It was only a few years ago, and I studied World War II in primary school and secondary school. I thought I'd read all the books and watched all the films. And then I came across this and I was like, wait, how have we missed this? And I asked my friends, my family, and nobody had come across this man, as you say, you know, why is his name not out there? And I mean, it's a tricky question. I think, to be honest, it comes down to the fact that this story of, you know, Muslims protecting their Jewish neighbors and their Jewish brothers and sisters doesn't really fit in with the convenient narrative that we always hear. It doesn't make sense with the politics and the media that dominate, you know, what we hear when we hear about these two faiths together. You know, we're always hearing about Muslims versus Jews and Jews versus Muslims, and the violence here and there is because of this. And really, really, it's not. So I think it's been perhaps a purposeful thing that's kind of, because it's not fitted in with politics, really, I think that's what it comes down to. And I'm really, really grateful to have been able to tell this story and hopefully to change that. I want people to know his name and to sing about this story. So I'm really, really honoured to have been able to do that.
It began as a deep, distant sound that grew in pitch and volume with every second, stopping Sophia still in her tracks. She'd only ever heard it before during an air raid practice with her family at home, and once at school. The haunting, falling and rising wail of the sirens had scared her on those occasions, but now Sophia felt terror like never before. This was no practice, and despite being on a busy street, Sophia was utterly alone. The howling seemed to fill the air around her, making it heavy and thick. People were panicking and scattering in different directions. Sophia had absolutely no idea where the nearest bomb shelter was, and was too frozen in fear to make a decision about what she should do. She pictured her gas mask lying under her bed at home, and fresh terror engulfed her. If only the howling of the sirens would stop, she might be able to think straight. She knew she needed to move, but she couldn't feel her feet.
Now, the audio version of the book is read by Shala Nix. Did you have any hand in the casting of her?
A little, yes. So I was actually asked by the company who have the audio rights for any like suggestions. I had to fill in a sheet that was kind of asking about what kind of voice, what kind of perhaps age, you know, if I wanted it in particular to be a man or a woman. And I mentioned that one thing that I really did want was that the voice was, I guess, sort of a warm, comforting voice, like a friendly voice, perhaps one that could maybe almost seem like at points it might have been Sophia's inner voice as well. So when they came with some suggestions, Shala was a really, really good option. And I loved the warmth. I loved the notes in her voice. And I felt like I could definitely see that happening. So I gave the go ahead. And I was really, really pleased that she'd been on the cards.
Did you ever consider doing it yourself?
Oh, gosh. I didn't know. I don't think I've got the right voice, to be honest. But no, it didn't cross my mind.
That's all we've got time for on today's edition of Read On. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, there are over 400 episodes available as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On. And remember to tune in every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. for our sister show, Talking Books, where we showcase the best that RNIB Library has to offer that we're allowed to play on air. Listen live or catch up online at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.